do I do that? Well, the voter rolls, as they stand right now in Oregon, about 1 in 3 of the people in the voter rolls are not supposed to be. They're illegal aliens. They're dead. They moved away, etc. But many of those are still active. And so since you do mail-in voting, you're mailing ballots to people who shouldn't be receiving them. And if the ratio is about 2 to 1, which is about that, it depends on the county, but it's about 2 to 1 across the state. For every 2 ballots you send to real voters, you're sending 1 ballot into the wind somewhere. And that's what you're talking about, chain of custody. So you can imagine that no matter how the elections go, you've got another, a third of the ballot out there floating around. Anybody who wants to cheat, anybody who wants to make sure they win, they just scrape up a few of those excess ballots and turn them in, and there you go. So that's the problem with mail-in voting. It's compounded by the fact that your voter rolls are so bad. And it's not just me saying the voter rolls are bad. You notice you're being sued by the Judicial Watch right now. The state of Oregon. Because your voter rolls are out of compliance with federal and even your own state laws. And it's so bad that the Department of Justice has even enjoined the investigation, and they're coming after you as well. So that's the real, I mean, if everybody was honest, mail-in voting wouldn't matter. But the fact is, a third of the people in your voter rolls don't belong there, and that's a big problem.
Now, would it be relatively easy, based on the way other states maintain their voter rolls, for Oregon and Washington and other states to maintain clean voter rolls that get the dead people off, the non-citizens off, the illegal aliens off, the folks who've moved somewhere else? Should it be relatively simple to solve that problem and at least get down to a list of people actually living in the state, still alive and registered to vote?
One would think that would be simple, but in fact, I've analyzed every voter rolls in the country. I've put several videos up on this. Nearly every voter roll in the country is a wreck. And the reason why is because the states have kind of, the clerks that run the elections have kind of fallen back to the lowest common denominator. What do I mean by that? Starting in 1993, National Voter Registration Act, some people call it motor voter, set it up so that they were encouraging the states to keep centralized copies of the voter rolls. So what would happen is all the counties would turn in their voter rolls to the state every month or every quarter or something like that. And then that enabled states to compare voter rolls state to state. So you could figure out, well, gee, John Smith moved from Oregon to Texas, so let's take him out of the rolls in Oregon. You could compare voter rolls. But it's had the opposite effect. What's basically happened is the local election officials have given up their responsibility. They're just relying on the state to do it. And in a state like Oregon, where you automatically put people in your voter rolls who get driver's licenses and health and human services and other government organizations, in a state like Oregon, your voter rolls have just shot way up. You got more people in your voter rolls now than you have people. And you're not alone. Most of the states in the country are in this dilemma. And it's simply because we've forgotten it as a people, that we used to run our own elections and we used to keep track of our own precinct books locally and all that stuff. But what's happened is the clerks have just kind of said, well, we give up. We're going to let the states run them. And so now they're centrally run state by state. And that's why it's such a mess. You really need to have local eyes on the situation. And that's what our clerks could do.
But you could have a check at the state level. I mean, as you said, John Smith moves to Texas. Texas lists him as registered. Oregon says, we'll pull him off. The state takes him off the state list and then says to the county where he was registered, he no longer belongs on the list. And if the county believes the state, then the county takes him off the list there as well. And you keep a nice, clean list, right?
I don't disagree with you. I think it could be possible and could be done that way. So then the question comes up, why are none of the states doing that? And the answer, sadly, is that, you know, it's the same old story. Governments never give up central control. As soon as you give central control to a government, they like it. And basically, having election systems that are manipulatable works to the advantage of centralized government. So there's no incentive on their part. Furthermore,
Dr. Frank, I'm going to come out to a break, but I want to get this one in. I think it's important. Is it worse in blue states than red states?
No,
Okay,
it's
good.
Just as bad. So, for example, in Kentucky, they got 105% of their people registered. Guess what? You have 105% of your people registered in the blue state. It's just as bad. It doesn't matter. R and D, it doesn't make a difference.
I want people to really let that sink in for a moment. You've got X number of people in a state who are, you know, of age and able to vote, and you have 105% of that number registered to vote. And you say, how could we have more registered voters than there are people who are able to vote? And the answer is because of bad voter rolls and bad controls by the state. And if it's just as bad in the red states, we got to take control of that. That's Dr. Douglas Frank. He's a physicist, inventor, and elections expert. He's going to be speaking at the Gathering of Eagles and a number of other places in the Pacific Northwest during his 10 days out this direction. Back in just a moment, we'll talk about Minnesota and the awful shooting there yesterday. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Adjust your volume. He's just that loud. Lars Larson.
Minnesota ranks the highest per capita for being a safe haven for transgender individuals in Minnesota. And can I just say, we can talk about economic growth and feeding children and growing the economy and creating jobs simultaneously with talking about everybody's human rights matters, and we shouldn't be demonizing them.
Yeah, we shouldn't demonize them. That is Tampon Tim Walz, the governor of the state of Minnesota, after yesterday's shooting that took the lives of two school children. At the time, they were sitting in the pews inside of a Catholic church, Annunciation Church, which is part of the private school, the Catholic school there in Minnesota, where the shooting happened. And the young man who committed the act, who murdered the two children, wounded 17 of them, thankfully, they will survive, we're told. He was a former student of that K through 8 private Catholic school. And why did he do it? I don't think there's any doubt why he did it. He was unhappy with his lot in life. But let me get into some of the details and what Tampon Tim has done and has not done. And also the mayor of Minneapolis, he's part of the problem as well. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on what we always call Conspiracy Theory Thursday. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. So 2 years ago, the Catholic schools in Minnesota were begging the governor of that state, Tim Walz. This is before he had that failed run for vice president with Kamala Harris last fall. But they were begging him for some help with security. And why? The governor wanted to pass a budget that would add $50 million for building and cybersecurity grant program, a grant program. And what the Catholic schools wanted was include all of the schools as eligible for funding, whether they are public, private, charters, non-public, whatever it happens to be. Guess what? They got nothing. They got absolutely nothing. And at the time, Minnesota had an $18 billion budget surplus, and they could have been able to fund it. You would think, and I've had a number of emails today saying, why don't we harden our schools? Well, I think some schools actually are hardened, including some of the private schools. But even that doesn't necessarily make the difference. Covenant Christian School in Tennessee was shot up by another trans. And I know I'm going to hear from people who say, well, you're demonizing trans. Let me make the case to you this way. You have a person who is unhappy with their situation. Now, there are lots and lots of people in society and in American society especially who are not happy with their circumstances in life. But this is a person who isn't happy with their gender. They believe that they are something else other than what they were born. Okay, if you're an adult, you can believe that. But does that mean that if I said you are a troubled individual, you'd have to agree? Well, when you read some of the manifesto from the killer who acted yesterday to take those lives in Minnesota, you understand he was very angry with his life. And all that had ever happened to him was that he decided he wanted to be a different gender. He thought of himself as a girl or a woman instead of a boy or a man. His parents affirmed his gender choice. They got his name changed. They got his gender changed on official state documents, which I think personally was a mistake. Because when somebody is having a mental illness problem, you don't go along with them and say, well, yeah, sure, what you believe is actually true. You try to get them some real psychiatric or psychological help. You get them some counseling. By going along with it, you don't necessarily, all you do is give society the excuse to say, we've taken care of the problem. You say you're a girl? Okay. It says so on the paperwork. You're now a girl. Now, all of that was accommodated for that young man, the killer from yesterday, who ended up taking his own life. That was done 6 years ago. So every time you hear people say, we have to acknowledge transgenders, we have to celebrate their choice to be a different gender than the way they were born. Does that actually work? Does it make them happy with their lot? Well, I would point to you that there is a long list of killers over the last 10 years who identified as trans. And the entire trans population of the United States has been estimated at less than 3 million. In other words, less than 1% of the population is transgender or claims to be transgender at one level or another. Some of them may be post-surgery. Some of them may be pre-surgery. Some may be taking the hormones. But you've got a mentally disturbed individual. And then you put on top of that, depending on what they're doing to make that transition from male to female or female to male, how do they end up doing that? Well, most notably by surgery, but oftentimes with hormones. Gee, when you put hormones into a person to change them from boy to girl or girl to boy, do you think that might have an effect on them? And not always necessarily a positive effect by adding hormones to their body that make them even more trouble. I don't know whether this young man had gone through surgical or hormonal treatment or not. The fact is, he was unhappy with his situation. He seemed to hate almost everyone. And in fact, what's really almost comical, like you're reading the Babylon Bee, is to see the story saying, was this about anti-Semitism? Well, he did say he hated the Jews. He hated Donald Trump. He hated a number of different groups. He hated Christians, apparently. But was it anti-Semitism? Oh, if it was anti-Semitism, why did he choose to shoot up a Catholic church? Does that one make sense to you? Or was it just that this person, as he said in his journal, was unhappy that he had made the choice to switch from boy to girl? And he said, I don't want to dress up in girly girls all the time. And I'm not a girl. I know that. But I know I'm not a man either. So you're confused at this point. Confusion, and then pour some hormones on top of it. And what do you necessarily or sometimes get? You get somebody who's very, very unhappy with their entire situation. And then you get states like Minnesota, where Tim Walz loves to run around saying, we need to celebrate these people. We shouldn't penalize them or demonize them. Okay, I understand that. How about a little security for the schools? No, we're not going to give you that. Let's go to Matt. Hey, Matt, welcome to the program. We're about a minute from the break. What's on your mind?
Well, Lars, I agree with you. This 17-year-old kid, he was very unhappy with life. He was a drain on society, and I think he should have gotten serious help, I think, before he did these murders. And didn't he kill himself or not?
He took his own life at the end. He had a shotgun, a pistol, and a rifle, and he took his own life at the end.
Yeah, you know, I had a job coach fairly recently that was kind of like him, not as bad, but he's not my job coach anymore, thank God, and he was just a nasty, negative person who was always looking at the bad side of life.
Okay, I don't understand where that was going, Matt, but I very much appreciate the call. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. We've got to talk about what's going on with these people, though, because they need to get some kind of help. And I think, honestly, that whole transgender movement, the fact that LGBTQ have taken this on as a political cause, it's a medical or mental problem or a little bit of both. It is not a political cause. And every time you say all we have to do is embrace them, affirm their gender choice, it gives society the excuse to say, okay, we've solved the problem. We don't have to try to counsel them. They don't need counseling. They know that they're a girl or they know that they're a boy. That does not fix the problem. So we got to make sure that that kind of thing gets addressed. And I think simply going to the transgender answer does not address the problem. In fact, if anything, it allows it to linger. 6 years into his transition from boy to girl, supposedly. He was apparently no better off and not any happier. And in fact, based on what he did yesterday, very, very angry at just about everyone around him. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest
Larson Show. When he talks, you have no choice but to listen. More with Lars.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails. Boy, we heard a lot of complaining from employers who say, we can't do business without those illegal alien laborers. And yet, I always thought that this would end up when somebody finally came along, like President Donald Trump, the first president to actually take on this problem of illegal alien laborers in the United States. I thought it would be a tremendous opportunity for American workers, because they'd say, well, if you want to get Americans to do that, you're going to have to pay them more. I said, yeah, ain't that great? You have to pay them more, and you'll be paying Americans instead of illegal laborers. And all I hear from the employers, from many of the employers, is we just can't get by with that, which is kind of the same thing we heard from the Democrat employers back before the Civil War, saying we can't possibly maintain these cotton plantations without a whole bunch of slaves. Well, they may have thought that was true, and there may be people today who think we can't possibly operate nurseries or vineyards or farms or dairies or anything else without having a bunch of illegal aliens. But I think it's an opportunity. So I thought I'd test that notion with Andrew Krapuschets, who's Red Balloon CEO. So he's a guy who tries to find jobs for people and employees for some companies that don't want woke employees. And there are people who don't want to work for a woke employer. Andrew, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me, Lars. And yeah, you're absolutely spot on. Like everyone's been freaked out about this, but I think it's such a wonderful opportunity for employers to strap in and say, okay, how do we use the American workforce to fill this gap? And it's interesting because there's two factors here. Sure. Just to jump right into it, right? There's two
Please
factors
do.
Here. First of all, you have the people who were employing illegal aliens in the past, but you also have all the direct foreign investment that Trump has been securing from countries around the world that is going to produce more jobs. So now we have more demand for jobs or for workers, and you have these illegal aliens going out. In fact, actually, an interesting stat I read this morning. All of last year, so in all of 2024, there were 244,000 reshore jobs. So these are jobs that had, you know, previously been sent to other countries, and they were reshored. So about 250,000 of those. Since Trump's election, in only the first quarter, we had 173,000 reshore jobs. So we're on track to basically triple what was produced last year in jobs coming back to the United States from the offshoring that was such a trend on the previous 4 years. So there's that factor, and then obviously have these people going down. This is a wonderful opportunity, though, because for many companies, and I talked to a business just yesterday who is kind of grappling with this. They said, look, we didn't ask about documentation for the people who work for us. They're in manufacturing. And they're like, and we were really concerned about it. But what we're finding is that when you are hiring American workers who speak English fluently, who understand technology, many of them, they're calling AI-enabled employees. So they're employees who know how to use AI to make themselves more efficient, sometimes as much as twice as efficient, because they're using AI in every little aspect of their job, even in manufacturing. They said the quality of our products are better, our customers are happy, we are actually making more money since we've even made this change. And that's the thing that these employers are missing when they think, oh man, I need to have just cheap labor, and they don't see their people as an asset, as someone who is going to be a creative agent that's going to make their business better. And so they're looking at this, well, what's the way that I can get the cheapest labor, no matter the quality? It is going to be a really good thing for the economy, even if there's a little bit of pain in the short term.
Well, and let me ask you about this notion as well, because, and again, I'm in a small business, but I only have three employees. So what happens when an employer says, well, we have somebody doing this because the labor is relatively cheap, but if labor got a little more expensive, we're going to automate that function. we're going to change it and have it done by a machine. So maybe you have three people doing a function. You say, but one person with a machine, somebody who knows how to run the machine, can do the work of those three people, and the economics of it work out as well. If it makes that kind of change, is that necessarily bad if you're getting rid of the illegal labor you don't want and don't need, and you're replacing it with American labor to do the job smarter?
Absolutely. I mean, you think about it in the construction industry, right? You go back to when, you know, excavators started to be prevalent, right? You go from needing to have 20 ditch diggers to a guy with a machine. And guess what? You can pay that person more. You're going to get a higher quality ditch. You're going to get it done more quickly, and it's going to save you money because you have this. Well, AI and some of the, you know, software and machines that are available today are really the excavator of the construction industry for lots and lots of jobs. And so these people are using this tool to make themselves, you know, you think of that excavator example, that might have been a 20-to-1 increase in productivity per person, right? Instead of needing 20 people, you only need one. And I talked to a software developer who's in Austin, Texas yesterday. He said, I am getting done the work of 10 engineers right now because I know how to use AI. And so I was able to go and ask for a raise because now they don't need to hire more as many people. And I'm using this tool, not having my job replaced, but instead being way more productive. So using it as a tool in the same way that using a nail gun instead of a hammer is a lot faster. And it will require you to have fewer people to get more work done, and the quality of work is actually going to be better. So anytime, you know, and there's a great economist, Schumpeter, who talked about creative destruction. Anytime an economy goes through this kind of creative destruction, like, okay, the way we did it before is changing, and it's going to cause some short-term pain for some people, but it will increase the quality of life for everyone in the long term. You just got to sit back and wait a minute.
Well, and the thing I keep hoping blue-collar Americans look at is you say if the number of available employees goes down because we're shipping or self-deporting millions of people out of the country, you say, well, that means we're not going to have as many workers. I said, yeah, isn't it? Wouldn't it be great to be in that position if you're a worker, you're a skilled tradesperson, and you say, my trade is very much in demand and they don't have as many people. Guess what? You get more money for it, right?
Absolutely. And Trump announced this when he fired the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Which
BLS.
Was great. But he actually announced that, like, we're seeing the average income of families in America up over $1,000 already this year. And that's because supply demand drives prices, and it drives prices in labor and everything else. And so if there are fewer workers to do the low-end jobs, then we're going to more efficiently use American labor using tools like AI and others to make them more efficient. They're going to earn more money. They're going to have a higher quality of life, and the whole economy wins because then those people are going to have more money to spend at grocery stores and shopping centers, in vacations, and it's going to just, it is going to have this ripple effect that's just going to be so good for the economy. And employers that are complaining about this just need to stop. Don't you agree, Lars?
Yeah, I agree. And by the way, I'm talking to Red Balloon CEO Andrew Kapuscheds. One last thing. I heard this morning the latest numbers on economic growth actually got bumped up a bit. I think they're in the high threes now, and they had been in the lower threes, and inflation is still down in the twos, not quite at the 2% they want. What do you see in the crystal ball coming up with those numbers? Economic growth is going, inflation is not.
Yeah, we're going to see interest rates come down a little bit. Some people think as early as next month. That's going to create economic activity. It's going to change housing prices. It's going to spur that. I think this really is a golden era for America. And honestly, the U.S. economy is so large, it's like a barge. It's not going to turn in just a minute. It's not a speedboat. It's an enormous ship. But it is turning faster than anybody thought it would. And I think you're seeing economic signs. And I get, you know, at redballoon.work, we're talking to businesses all over this country, and people are on go. We talk to businesses. We do this this survey of all of our businesses,
yeah,
and only 15% are still removing employees, whereas now we've gone from 10% who are adding for growth employees, and now we're at 30% that are looking to grow their goal base. So,
wow, that is Andrew Kapuscheds, CEO of redballoon.work. Thanks so much, Andrew. Back in a moment. You got the Lars Larson Show. So you're...
You actually want to be at. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. In a moment, I've got to tell you about the latest crash and burn of the Biden administration with its electric school bus program. $159 million of the taxpayers' money, except the company in Canada known as Lion Electric Buses, based in Quebec, Lion Electric, they got $159 million to build 435 school buses between 2022 and 2024. They've gone bankrupt. And I guess my question is, what is going to happen to the school districts in the Pacific Northwest? And I know there are several of them. Beaverton Schools, Bend Lapine Schools, Portland Schools have all acquired Lion buses as part of their first electric bus initiative. Only now, throughout the country, you've got a whole bunch of school districts who got sold on this crazy idea because it was free money from Washington, D.C., and the Biden administration said, we're going to give this company up in Canada all this money and get away from diesel and start running electric school buses, and now the company has gone bust. Yeah, and in fact, some of the districts around America that have these electric school buses say they are not they take a lot of repair, let's put it that way, and they're having a tough time finding companies that know enough about the buses to be able to repair them. So it sounds like they are saddled with some real white elephants. On that note, let's go to Mark. Hey, Mark, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Early on that shooting, they said something about that Robin's mother disowned him, and that the reason why he went to that school is that's where his mother worked.
His mother did work at the Annunciation School. I don't know that she disowned him because she actually helped him with the court process of changing his name 6 years ago.
Oh, okay, well,
but what's the bottom line? What's your point that you're trying to make, Mark?
It's like that school shooting, Sandy Point, where
Sandy Hook.
The son killed his mother and then went 80 miles to the school where she worked and was shooting up the kids there.
Well, how are the two alike? Because, yes, both of the killers had a mother who worked in education. Adam Lanza went to the Sandy Hook School and murdered both students and teachers. He was under psychiatric treatment. The man yesterday was I guess not under psychiatric treatment, but had decided that he was a girl and not a woman and not a man. Yeah. But then in his manifesto admitted, I'm not happy being transitioned to a girl. So it suggested that he was not getting the help that he needed.
Okay, well, you set me straight. I'm sorry.
No, I'm glad to do it because I want people to understand all the details of this. And, Mark, it's one of the reasons why when I started out with a couple of emailers who had said, hey, you should stop mentioning the names and the details about people involved in these killings because they're looking for attention. If we don't talk about the details, how do you get to solutions? In other words, if you say, is this transgender stuff mentally problematic? I mean, are the people who are suffering from this transgenderism, is it a DSM mental illness? It is. Just simply admitting, oh, you say you're a girl, okay, you're a girl, does that solve the problem? It apparently does not. We've had a tremendous number of killings in the last 10 years, and there's been a spate of them that all involve transgender, even though transgender is a tiny, tiny percentage of the entire population. They seem to have a very disproportionate number of killers. Now, I know there are people saying, well, Lars, you're saying that all transgenders are evil killers or evil people. I'm not. But I am saying that if you start to notice that there's a pattern, and I'd suggest this pattern, Mark, who do you think commits more crimes, men or women?
Yeah,
I'll skip
I'm
to
not
the
too
end.
Happy
He's,
about
it's men. It's men. Men commit about 90% of the crimes that get you locked up in prison. Women do less than 10%. Now, is that anti-male bias? No. men commit more crimes than women. If you notice that and you say, well, then we should address that problem. If you start to notice that transgender individuals who are unhappy, mentally unhappy with their given gender that they were given at birth by God, then do you say, should we address that as a problem? You say, no, you should just go along with whatever notion they want to tell you that somehow I believe that I'm a woman, so therefore I am a woman. Well, you know, as a number of people have said before me, thank goodness you didn't tell your parents you were a pirate. They would have had one eye and one leg removed. Glad to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@larslarson.com. And naysayers always go to the head of the line. This segment of the show is brought to you by nickshivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showings, no hassles, and you pick the closing date, nickshivers.com, for details. And our X poll question today, should Trump take Oregon and Washington school money for teaching gender ideology? It's a really important question. Federal funds will not be used to poison the minds of the next generation or advance dangerous ideological agendas. That is the statement from the person who runs Children and Families Program at the federal level. Oregon and Washington get a lot of money from that program. They have now been told, take the gender nonsense out of your curriculum, and if you don't, the cash ain't coming. It's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com.
The Lars Larson Show.
So, in exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network. Lars. And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment. I want you to imagine this. A member of your family is killed in the line of work that he does, and you want to make sure that his killer stays behind bars. That is exactly the proposition that was made to me. Sandra Bierscheid wrote to me, the daughter of an Oregon State Police Sergeant, James Shepard, who was killed 45 years ago, and I thought I'd bring her on because... Ms. Bierscheid, welcome to the program. You would like to see this awful murderer stay behind bars, wouldn't you?
Yes, I would. And thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
I'm glad to do it. Before I go any further, please tell my audience about your father.
My dad was an Oregon State policeman, and he worked out of the Astoria branch as a sergeant at the time that this happened. Very loving father. I have an older brother and myself, and had an amazing relationship with my mother, who suffered the greatest loss imaginable. So yeah, a really good guy. All about second chances and helping people. Like he would help anybody at the drop of a hat. Just a good guy.
And you were 14 when he was murdered.
Yes.
Tell me what you remember of that.
Our family had gotten a permit to cut wood up in the, I think it was a Weyerhaeuser property up behind our house. And so my brother and he had gone up to kind of scout out a place to cut wood. And they saw this man up there. And my dad kind of knew there was some marijuana growing operations up there. And so it piqued his curiosity, of course, being a policeman, but he was off duty at the time. So he brought my brother home and then later went back up on his motorcycle to kind of assess the situation. And this man saw him and I guess was frightened because he had a grow operation, probably knew this was a policeman, small town, and decided to shoot him off his bike. And then shoot him again two more times in the head to make sure that was done. Took his bike and booked it. And they caught him a few days later I think he was in California, if I remember right.
And this was so Michael Stuhr who did that. But I want to know, Sandra, yes, how did you react to the news? I mean, you knew your dad was in a dangerous line of work, but on the day when you got the news that he had been murdered, doing what he was supposed to do, even though he was off duty at that point, he's being a cop. How did you react at 14?
I vividly remember that moment because my mom knew that he was going up there and didn't think it was a great idea. He wasn't armed. He wasn't at work. And so we heard the shots from our house, and we went out to his patrol car and turned on the radio and heard what was going on. And I just remember being very numb, completely numb for many days after that happened, and kind of living in a bubble while the world went around and we weren't moving. That was what I remember the most.
Do you remember the trial of Michael Stuhr and the sentence he was given?
In the beginning, because I was so young, I remember it happening. I didn't fully understand. I understood the word life in prison, and I just assumed, okay, good. He's where he belongs. He'll be there rest of his life. And as a kid, that's what I believed. And then later learned, oh, that's not really the case.
What's the reality of what's going on right now? And why are they considering his release?
Well, he's had a few parole hearings. And the first one, I felt pretty secure. He didn't really want to be let out. Plus, he'd been making mistakes in prison, dabbling in drugs with the wrong people, getting in trouble. And the second hearing, he didn't show up to because he'd been in trouble, I think, and realized, well, this is a pointless hearing to go to. But then the last hearing in 2021, he showed up. He had this whole army of people that have been coaching him. He was saying all the right things. This is the first time he ever made an apology, if you call it that. It was like he was very well coached for that hearing.
When he said the apology, what did he say? I'm sorry I killed your dad?
I don't remember the exact words he used, something to the effect of sorry that he put our family through this, which, you know, he's had many years to dive into that if he'd have wanted to. He's diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, which, you know, if you read about that, which I've read a lot about it, you don't have a lot of remorse for your actions. Kind of fly off the handle easy. It's not something that's like fixable. It can kind of be controlled if you're in the right environment. So I had a lot of doubt going into the last hearing with the governor that we had. Letting people out kind of seems to be the new trend. So I have huge fear of that happening to this man.
And now he's coming up for parole again.
Yes, November 5th.
And you're worried because you said Oregon leaders seem to be soft on crime and consequences, a conclusion I would agree with.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're hearing more and more about it. And I don't know how the parole board is constructed, who they put on the board. I don't know how they choose that process exactly, but, I mean, Portland, Eugene, Seattle, all these areas seem to not have a lot of consequences, you know, kind of cheering on the defund the police thing. And it causes me huge anxiety that this could potentially change what's right.
And put this antisocial personality back on the street. Last question I'd like to ask you, and I know we'll talk to you after or coming up to November 5th. When the jury said life in prison, should life mean life?
I always understood that that's what that meant. But when I look back and read the files from the beginning, it states that it said the prosecutors agreed not to seek the death penalty in exchange for his confession, and that the term generally used in criminal law in murder cases is that they would remain in physical custody until they pass away. However, a parole board has the authority to change that.
Ms. Bierscheid, thank you very much. That's Sandra Bierscheid. She's the daughter of an Oregon State Police Sergeant James Shepard. He was murdered 45 years ago. His killer comes up for parole in November. And I think Ms. Bierscheid is right that the politics of today is that they're going to look to let this guy go, even though he has anti-societal personality disorder. Back in a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
Because you can't get enough, Lars. Podcast every show at LarsLarson.com.
What we know is not working is a break in trust between police and community, especially with new federal partners in our community. We know having masked ICE agents in the community has not worked, and National Guards from other states has not been an efficient use of those resources.
Now, that is Muriel Bowser. She is the mayor of Washington, D.C., and that's what she was saying just a few days ago, saying, this National Guard stuff and putting ICE agents and other federal agents on the streets of D.C., that's just not going to work. It's not a good way to do it. Just a few days ago. I mean, in some ways, this is absolutely amazing because it is Donald Trump applying policies that are so common sense that all the Democrats know to do is say, if Trump is doing it, then it must be bad. And so we must oppose it, which is exactly what they did. Except you notice the Democrat Party has gone a bit radio silent on all of these subjects in the last couple of days. And why? Because Washington, D.C., had a gigantic murder rate last year, almost 500 people murdered in 365 days. Do the math on that. In the first 6 months of this year, you know, all those Democrats who ran around and talked about, well, it's lower this year. Yeah, lower meaning 100 murders in the first 6 months. So that'd be 100 murders in 360 or 200 murders in 365 days if we kept going at that rate, meaning you have two murders every 3 days on average in Washington, D.C. Well, ending night before last, Washington, D.C. saw its first period where they went 13 days without a single homicide. And lots of other crimes have gone down as well, and there have been a lot of arrests. So I want to show you the amazing transformation. It's like one of those before and after ads on TV. Here's what Lars looked like before he combed his hair, and here's what he looks like after he applied the special new hair goo. Well, that was Muriel Bowser, mayor of Washington, D.C., saying, we know what doesn't work. You're breaking trust with the community. You're putting all these federal agents on the streets, and that's just not a good way to do it. Guess what she's saying now?
And we greatly appreciate the surge of officers that enhance what MPD has been able to do in this city. But for carjackings, the difference between this period, this 20-day period of this federal surge and last year represents a 87% reduction in carjackings in Washington, D.C.
Now, is that amazing or what? Because what was comical to me is I think it probably would have been sensible if the Democrats and the folks in D.C. had said, hey, Trump's going to try this anti-crime thing in Washington, D.C. And so we'll just stand back and watch. If it turns out well, we won't say anything about it at all. That would have been the smart move. But, of course, the Democrats didn't take the smart move. They said, let's stand up and object to what the president is doing. Let's say that whatever it is he's doing, no matter how much common sense is behind it, it's a terrible idea. It's not going to work. It's a bad use of resources and all the rest of that. Now they're forced to admit they could have simply stayed silent. And then when it worked out well, say, yeah, we very much appreciate the president's assistance with this problem. That is exactly what they're doing now, because Bowser has actually gone so far. Remember when the Democrats just a couple of weeks ago were saying it is outrageous that Donald Trump should take control of Washington, D.C., which, by the way, is mentioned in the Constitution, not the name itself, but the fact that the Constitution provides that the federal government is allowed to have land on which it can establish all of the buildings and facilities to house the federal government. And that is Washington, D.C. It's not one of the 50 states. It is its own little special district just to house the federal government. And so now they're saying, well, you know, it turned out to be a pretty good idea. 87% reduction in carjackings. And you can imagine, how does the local population react when President Trump, I know, a largely predominantly black population in Washington, D.C., many of whom, if not most of whom, are members of the Democrat Party, probably voted for Kamala Harris last fall because they were told, you're a Democrat and she's a black candidate. You have to vote for her. I have a feeling an awful lot of Washington, D.C. residents, even if they won't vote for Trump, vote for conservatives, they might just say, you know, what he's doing is actually good. And I've seen some man on the street interviews in which people say, yep, this is working out well. Guess what Muriel Bowser is now saying? She signaled that she would like to continue the work with the federal government to police the city after Trump's emergency declaration times out at the end of 30 days. We're about halfway through that period. It has been 2 weeks in, and already Muriel Bowser is transformed. Does that mean she's going to sign up as a member of the grand old party? Probably not. I don't think we could be that optimistic. But she says, this is what we think. In just a couple of weeks of experience, it has worked. Having more federal law enforcement officers on the street, this is a quote, we think having more stops, we've got to get the guns, and that has helped. We think there's more accountability in the system, or at least perceived accountability, that was driving down illegal behavior. She's admitting that it actually worked and it made sense. So that's a transformation. Now, the next step is you've got to get a bunch of reporters to go to the mayors of every big city in America that has a crime problem, which means every big city in America, and say to them, if Trump did this, would the same thing work in our city? And if reporters aren't doing it, they aren't doing their jobs. Let me go first to Bill. Hey, Bill, and if you want to join in, it's 866-439-5277. Bill, what's on your mind?
Hello. Is this Lars?
Yes, it's Lars. It's the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind today?
Okay. I kind of agree with you, what you're talking about at the Capitol and stuff, because in the Constitution, it's like there is a loophole, but I don't see why he's going to send them to all these other cities, and mostly because why isn't he sending them to all the cities?
Bill, I thought I explained that. Washington, D.C. was created by the U.S. Congress. And when folks said Trump is taking control of D.C., Washington, D.C. has always been a federal.
I'm talking about the other cities.
They weren't created by the federal government. Every other city in America was created by the state
it sits in. Yeah, but he still wants to send the National Guard there.
And if they're invited, I think they should.
Yeah, I think if they're invited, that's another thing. But if you're not welcome there, you're probably not going to do as much.
Can you tell me something, Bill? Does the president he took an oath that said he'd protect and defend the Constitution and faithfully execute the laws of the United States. Do you think most of the big cities in America are following the law and serving the citizens well?
Probably not any better than the rural areas, I agree.
Then if that's the case, if you live in a city and the local officials say, we're not going to fix crime, we could, but we're not going to, and is President Trump supposed to look at that and say, well, I guess sucks to be you if you're a citizen there because your local officials won't do anything and I won't either? Should he do that?
Well, I don't think everybody should scream at once in the beginning, because sometimes the things he wants to do work out.
Can you tell me one that's worked out badly?
It's like flipping a coin, isn't it?
No, you give me one. If you say sometimes it works out, of all the initiatives he's done in this term of office, tell me something that worked out badly.
That worked out badly?
Yes. I can tell you 50 things that worked out badly for Joe Biden. Give me one thing that worked out badly under Donald Trump. See, that's the problem. The Democrats would love to have something to complain about, but they can't find out what it is. Bill, thanks very much. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Email talk at LarsLarson.com. He actually reads them. More with Lars right now.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, Conspiracy Theory Thursday seems like a fantastic day to suggest to you maybe the housing market is in the middle of a collapse, but officials are saying, but the numbers show everything is fine, nothing to see here, folks, move along. So I thought I'd ask our favorite real estate guy, and that's Nick Shivers, one of the many great supporters of this program with his real estate business, the Nick Shivers team. Nick, welcome back to the program.
Always a pleasure to be here, Lars.
I hear from people. In fact, yesterday I heard from a gentleman who said, yeah, I had a condominium, and I'd sold it, and he said he sold about 6 years ago, and now the number on that condominium is lower than what he sold it for 6 years ago. And I thought, well, in ordinary times, you'd expect 3% appreciation a year. Apparently, he had 20% depreciation. Do we have a housing market that's in danger of going into a bubble explosion like what we saw in 2008?
Simple, no, we do not.
Okay.
Now, Lars, I will say there's certain areas like
here
downtown,
comes the caveat.
Yeah, the Pearl District, absolutely. Condo markets in Tampa and Florida across the board, absolutely. Those are already down. We've seen, 15 to 30% depreciation in multifamily across the board.
Wow.
But overall, the housing market, the reality is this year, it's went up about 1.2%, not factoring in inflation. So we absolutely do not have a bubble. In certain areas, we might, but Pacific Northwest, no. Areas downtown Portland, certain areas in Southeast where we have issues with crime, yes, we're seeing depreciation.
Okay, so does that mean places like Chicago and Philadelphia and New York might have some areas of depreciation as well or not?
Certain areas, yeah. Chicago, yes. New York actually has been going up because they had kind of a exodus to Florida. Moldavi gets elected. That will change the pattern there for sure. Some buddies already that I talk to on a regular basis in Florida have already seen a little bit of uptick in luxury because people are leaving New York right now because they believe the writing's on the wall that that's actually going to happen.
Okay, I want to ask you about another metric that I saw that was the reason I sent you a note and said, can you come on the program? And that was contracts that were withdrawn, meaning when you go in to buy a house and you make an offer and the seller says, okay, I'll take that offer, but you're not done with the deal yet. You've already put some earnest money down, which if you decide to pull out for no reason, in many cases, you're going to lose that money. So there's a consequence for doing that. But the number that were withdrawn has apparently hit a record rate. If that's not true, I want to know. 15% of the houses that were under contract last month, the contract was withdrawn and people walked away from their earnest money and said, no, I'm not going to do the deal. What's going on there?
Okay, so what we're seeing a lot of is, and yes, that is true. What we're seeing is new construction. Remember, new construction and resale are different animals. New construction has an inventory level of about 10 months. The builders were still building before the, 2023 kind of slowed down everything. So the supply is the highest it's been in since 2007. So
wow.
10 months of inventory. 10 months of inventory. So what they're allowing people to do is make offers contingent on them selling their resale house. And the fact is right now, we have been in a recession for the amount of transactions. I mean, lowest numbers in 35 years, factoring in population growth. So these people are going into contract, not being able to sell their resale home, and then, of course, not being able to move forward with the contract.
Now, how much of that is because of interest rates right now? The reason they're not able to sell their home is because the people who like to buy it say, yeah, but money is 6% plus, and I can't afford it.
Yeah, so it's that sellers are still wanting 22 prices, and they're wanting to buy properties in 25 prices, right? Because we have seen about a 6% depreciation since the peak in July of 2022. So again, I understand if you have a 3% interest rate, you're trying to get your maximum value. You don't get it. You're going into a new construction that's going to be a 5% interest rate, even with a new construction buy down. That makes it a lot challenging. Now, the good news, Lars, we have the lowest mortgage rates of 2025 just today at 6.5% on a 30-year fixed.
Now, isn't that amazing to say that's the lowest rate at 6.5%? Because that's a punishing rate of interest, isn't it? Or am I looking at this? Because remember, my first house I bought on a private contract. You know what? The owners, yeah, they owned it outright, and I didn't know them. It was an arm's length deal. It was 11%. You say 11%? What, were you crazy? I said, well, mortgage rates at the time were 15. So I thought I was getting a fairly good deal. Should we look at 6.5 as the new normal for mortgages? Or are we likely to see something lower than that anytime soon?
If our president has a say in it, we will get down to fives. I believe that mid next year we will be down to fives, especially after Powell, too late Powell gets taken away. Now, people, well, that's going to cause inflation. But like a direct quote from Reagan, we don't have a inflation problem because people live too well. We have an inflation problem because the government lives too well. And I think Trump is getting after that to some extent. I mean, again, when you have a sinking ship, it takes a while to turn it around, right? So the tariffs haven't affected inflation like everybody said it was going to. So strong growth, GDP, jobless claims staying steady. I believe that we will see a rate cut in September of this year. Interest rates will keep coming down, making homes more affordable. I do believe that we will have a strong fourth quarter across the board, not just in the Pacific Northwest, but across the board.
Okay, but Nick, this makes me never want to listen to experts again, because the experts all said, all those tariffs are going to drive inflation way up. Well, it's down the mid-twos, mid to low-twos. And they said, the economy isn't going to grow the way Trump said it would. And, you know, Obama said that, Biden said that. And now I heard as of this morning, we're in the mid-threes for growth, which sounds pretty healthy. So healthy growth, healthy inflation on its way to the right level, and the tariffs didn't do what everybody said they were going to do. Now, that sounds like it adds up pretty well. Is there any fly in the ointment on that one?
You know, I'm with you. You'll get 100 different so-called experts, and they all have predictions. They say, you know, I think a weatherman is more right than an economist, right? But you got to look at the dynamics. The areas that we're seeing job growth are doing well. The areas that are not, good tax policy, job growth, you still, people are moving into those areas. Those areas that don't have that are still struggling. I mean, downtown Portland is a perfect example. You can't have those type of policies, high permits, high fees, and expect affordable housing.
No, but if they keep doing that and they ignore the fact that San Antonio, Texas saw more housing built, just crazy amounts of housing built, why? They took all the stupid government rules off. And I think after a few years, I can't wait for the day, Nick, where some developer watches a city councilor or a county commissioner or the state legislature say, we're thinking about adding this rule, and say, hey, remember the last time you had that rule? Didn't work out so well. And then you got rid of it and things got a whole lot better. And now you want to bring it back? I mean, you know, burn once, twice shy, right?
Yeah. I mean, again, right now, I think the average sales price in San Antonio is like $280,000. So that's an affordable house.
Yeah, it certainly is. Nick Shivers from the Nick Shivers team, one of the many great supporters and a great resource when it comes to figuring out what does it mean when people are having to walk away from a home sales deal and say, can't do it because I can't sell my house. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Worried.
right on the left coast. Get it? Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Imagine this as we head up to the special session of the Oregon Legislature tomorrow. The Democrats, I think the Democrats are kind of stuck in a tough spot because they had a regular session of the legislature and they said, hey, how about we raise taxes by $15 billion over the next 10 years? And the answer to that was no. A solid no, even by the Democrats who had the votes. There were enough Democrat votes to be able to pass that nonsense. And then they had a smaller package and said, well, how about the smaller package? And even the Democrats said, no, we don't have the guts to do that one either. In other words, when you find a proposal for taxes that even the Democrats don't like, because they usually like taxes all day long and twice on Sunday, when even the Democrats are saying no, so they ended the regular session with no tax package passed for ODOT. Now, I don't want to call it a transportation package, and I want to tell you a couple of reasons why. Number one, they've calculated that about 6% of the money in that package is actually going to roads. You say, well, where's the other 94% going? Well, it's going to transit, it's going to hiking and biking paths, it's going to DEI and CRT and woke nonsense and garbage everywhere. You say, well, how are you calling it a transportation package if only 6% of it has anything to do with roads and bridges and traveling around the state? But because that's the only way they can sell it. Can you imagine the Democrats coming out saying, we'd like billions of dollars for diversity, equity, and inclusion? People aren't going to buy that. They aren't, so they have to call it something else. Kind of like same way that Joe Biden and the Democrats at the federal level said, let's have something where we have hundreds of billions of dollars that we give to our friends in the green energy scams that are being run all over America. And they say, but we can't call this the big green energy scam bill. We have to call it something that'll make it somewhat popular. So they said, I know, we'll call it the Inflation Reduction Act. Except that anybody who looked at it said that isn't going to reduce inflation. If anything, it will dramatically increase inflation. And in fact, it has done just that. They also they didn't want to call it the big green energy scam bill, even though now we're finding out almost every day about more of these scams that are falling apart, having been funded with tens or hundreds of billions of dollars of your money and my money. And you say, well, that turned out to be a scam. Well, did you tell us it was going to be a scam? No, we called it the Inflation Reduction Act that didn't reduce inflation. So guess what's going to happen? Having spent about the last 10 years trying to persuade people in the Pacific Northwest to buy electric cars, which I've always thought was kind of an abundantly stupid idea. And why? Because do I hate electric cars? No, they're a piece of technology. Do they work well for most people's needs? No. Do they cost dramatically more than the gasoline or diesel equivalent? Yes. Well, then why would I want to buy something that doesn't meet my needs and, in fact, costs a lot more money than an alternative vehicle? All I care about is getting from A to B. I really don't care whether I get there by electricity, by propane, by natural gas, by diesel, by gasoline, you know, by passenger pigeon. I just want to get where I'm going. Does it do that? Yes, but it costs a lot more and all that. So what happened? Well, they managed to persuade about 117,000 rubes in the state of Oregon to buy electric or plug-in hybrid vehicles, the ones that are supposed to mostly run on electricity, and most of that is a scam, the ones that are supposed to save the earth from global warming and climate change. And they don't do that either because they take so many different materials that you have to put into those electric vehicles for the batteries and all that. That doesn't save the earth. They wear tires out a whole lot faster than a regular gasoline or diesel car because the battery weighs so much. So that ain't saving the earth. But they did get people to buy it. I mean, at one point, if you lived in the state of Oregon, I now live in the state of Washington, but I lived in the state of Oregon for decades, you could have been able to buy an electric or plug-in hybrid with $15,000 in rebates. Except these are government rebates, meaning your fellow taxpayers are helping to fund the cost of your vehicle. So all these people lined up, not one of them apparently said to himself or herself, I wonder if this is such a great thing, this electric car. Why are they paying me something to buy it? I mean, I would suggest just generically, as you go through life, if you ever have to be paid to do something, it's probably, I mean, if you get paid for work, that's one thing. But if somebody says, hey, come down to the coast, Washington coast, Oregon coast, we'll pay you to come there. It's a wonderful place. If you say, if it's such a wonderful place, why do you have to pay people to go there? Well, you don't. You don't have to pay people to go to the coast. You don't have to pay people to go to the mountains. You don't have to pay people to go whitewater rafting in Oregon or Washington or mountain climbing on Mount Rainier or Mount Hood. You don't have to pay people to do that. They pay for the privilege. In the case of electric cars, they are, again, that kid that is so ugly that they have to tie a pork chop around his neck to get the family dog to play with him. So having paid all these people, saying, please buy these electric cars, we're desperate to sell them. And that was the only way they got them sold. If they weren't offering those gigantic rebates, they wouldn't have sold many electric cars at all. Guess what the special session of the legislature is going to propose to do when they start meeting tomorrow? And I know they hope to wrap things up very quickly and then beat feet out of town before the taxpayers get their pitchforks and torches together. They are now going to add a fee for driving electric vehicles. Now, do I think they should pay a fee? I do. I don't think electric vehicles, they don't pay gas taxes. And so they should have to pay for the privilege of driving on the roads. But can you imagine what a wake-up call it's going to be? We talked you into buying this car by paying you money to buy it, and now we're going to tax it right back out of your pocket. Boy, wouldn't you feel stupid. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show.
News 101.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I think the question's a very simple one. Should we hold off on telling the public the names of killers like the one who murdered children in Minneapolis yesterday? I've been getting emails about it in the last 24 hours, and I'm not surprised by that. Although you might be surprised by my answer to that. I think it's a terrible idea, and I don't think it's going to change much of anything. But let me get into the details of that in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to have you with me on what we've always called Conspiracy Theory Thursday. And if you've got a favorite conspiracy theory, I'd be glad to have you share it with me and with the folks who listen to this show. It's easy to do. 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, boy, naysayers, for more than 25 years, we've always put naysayers to the head of the list at 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. A lot of my naysayers come in that way as well. And you can vote in our X poll. You'll find our daily poll question listed at Lars Larson Show on X. You can also find it on my website at LarsLarson.com. Now, there is not a single day that I've done this show in almost 30 years now that I haven't been inspired by one or many emails that I get from people who write to the show. But this one really caught me off guard because it's somebody who writes from time to time, not somebody who writes every day. And there are people who write every day. God bless them. But Charles Heath wrote in about what happened yesterday in Minneapolis. And of course, that was the murder of two young children, the wounding of 17. Most of those, thankfully, we are told are going to survive what happened. But can you imagine the horror that somebody decided to go to his former school because he is unhappy with his transgender status? He's dead now, by the way, which is probably not the worst result in the world. But I just wish he hadn't taken children with him. But I got this email from Charles who said, Lars, why do we as a society continue to allow the one thing that motivates mass shooters? Well, I'll give you my thoughts on that in just a moment. This is not about gun control. It's about protecting freedom of the press instead of protecting innocent lives. So he's put it as an equation. You either protect freedom of the press or you protect innocent lives. You can't do both, in Charles's view. Every time another sick, evil coward, he writes, whose life has not turned out so well, goes out and sprays a church or a school with a hail of bullets, we give them exactly what they want, that being posthumous glory. Lars, would you support federal legislation that going forward prohibits the release of names, photos, and limits information about mass shooters? I'll tell you my answer to that question in a moment. I know this infringes on the First Amendment and freedom of the press, but we have a serious crisis in this country. And if it helps stop what's driving these killers to act out, that does not benefit or outweigh the freedom of information. Seriously, posthumous attention is what these disturbed subhumans desire. It's obvious that is what they want. Why give it to them? Signed, Charles Heath. Now, I got a second email from somebody who took the other point of view. Lars, before it was taken down, there were screenshots of the page of the killer he's referring to yesterday in Minneapolis. Not a comment on the content, which I didn't view, but quite a number of people have been saying that something should have been done after it was posted. The murderer had a total of 43 followers on the page. In practical terms, no one saw the postings. We hope that the FBI investigates all 43, including any of which were FBI or YouTube agents or workers. All the best, signed Kevin. Now, let me get back to the point that Charles made. And I'm going to answer very simply. It is a terrible idea, in my view, to limit information that the public gets about bad things that happen. So, number one, he makes the point that there is a single motivation for mass shooters in America. That is simply not true. For example, Ted Bundy was motivated by sick sexual fascination with murdering young ladies who looked a particular way. In fact, my friend, the late crime writer Ann Rule, always said that she was totally safe. She didn't know that she'd been working right next to Bundy at the suicide hotline, but she said, I wasn't his type. He had a type, and he targeted that type, and he got his sexual satisfaction by killing. That is an example of a motivation. Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, he was a guy who was motivated by a hatred of technology and some of the people associated with technology. And say, John Wayne Gacy, who was a mass killer of children, he was a pedophile. I think anybody who tells you there is a single motivation for mass killers and that all they want is publicity, I think that is mistaken. There is nothing in the Minneapolis Killer's Manifesto that suggests he was seeking glory. There's a lot in there that suggests he hated just about everyone. He attacked his own former school. It was a K-8 school, or is a K-8 school, in Minneapolis, Minnesota, Annunciation Catholic School. So he's attacking something that he was associated with. Now, if there was some deeper motivation in that, thinking that maybe his family's Catholic beliefs had something to do with his confusion about his gender, I don't know. But there is nothing in there that says what I'm looking for is some kind of glory or recognition. There's a lot that suggests he was very unhappy with his own decision 6 years ago, which was endorsed and supported by his parents, to change his gender from his birth gender, male, to a female gender and change his name. His parents supported it. They affirmed his gender choice. I think that is foolish. I don't think it solves anything. Now, would you propose that police agencies hold back information selectively? Let me tell you something. One of the last attackers of a Christian school was Audrey, known as Audrey Hale. She attacked the school, the Covington School in Tennessee. Now, did the police hold back information there? Yes, they did. And do we know now what was in that manifesto that she wrote? Yes, we do. And do we know something about her motivation? And yet, at that point, the police were already selectively holding back information for political reasons. Is that a good idea? I don't think so. Would you propose that news agencies voluntarily hold back information? Well, there's too much of that going on right now. In fact, you got that joker Jake Tapper on CNN saying, well, the killer preferred to be known by a female pronoun. I don't care what the killer preferred to be known by. That doesn't really matter. When you're talking about the gender preferences or the pronoun choices of people who killed children, who cares what they prefer? And if news organizations got their information independently, would you forbid them from publishing it? So even if you told all the police agencies and the DA and the courts, you can't release information for publication by news organizations, if they get it on their own, are you going to suggest a law, a thoroughly unconstitutional law that says hold this information back from the public because it's damaging to have it out in the public? Didn't we get a real serious taste of that kind of nonsense when they went to war against what the Biden administration called misinformation during the COVID pandemic? And we saw how it worked out. More information is always better. Less information is not going to solve any problem whatsoever. Glad to have you with me. Always glad to take your calls at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis.
Guessing what he'll say next. Here's Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Minneapolis school children praying in their own church died yesterday or suffered grievous wounds because of America's embrace of transgenderism. I know there are a lot of people who aren't going to like me saying it, but you got to say it out loud. That is what's going on. The killer, Robin Westman, left behind solid evidence of his motives. That means most of the cartel media will run away from this story very quickly. 6 years ago, then Robert Westman told his parents he was a girl. He wanted a name change and a gender change. They supported his decision and went to court to change his name and gender. In some ways, you can't blame him because most of society, polite, woke, PC society, has been demanding that everybody endorse and even aid and abet these people in their delusion. It didn't do Robert Westman any good, and it ended yesterday when he blew his own brains out. Westman joins a list of about a dozen trans killers who have attacked Americans over the last decade. Let that sink in for just a moment. The best estimates are that trans Americans number about 1% of the population, and yet a dozen trans killers in the last decade, and that's being very, very conservative. In his manifesto, Westman confessed he is tired of being trans, his words, not mine, and that, quote, I wish I never brainwashed myself. He had plenty of help. LGBTQ activists who declare society must embrace and affirm transgenderism. Politicians who embrace gender change nonsense. Doctors and hospitals, including OHSU and UW, who make piles of money mutilating children with drugs or knives or both in the name of trans. In the end, the killer voiced his hatred for Christians, Jews, and Donald Trump. That's yet another reason why most of the mainstream media will want to forget about this story just as fast as they possibly can. In fact, there was an ABC television reporter yesterday who really seriously showed what you can do with bad information. I mean, on the gun, the killer wrote, "Kill Donald Trump." Now, those are his words, not mine, so don't have the Secret Service come on by. But he wrote that on the gun. So what did this ABC News reporter say? Well, he left a lot of things behind and he wrote Donald Trump's name on the gun. So you would be led to believe perhaps that maybe the killer identified with Donald Trump. No, he wanted Donald Trump dead. In his manifesto, Westman wrote, I don't want to dress girly all the time. I know I am not a woman, but I definitely don't feel like a man. That sounds like some serious confusion. Society should have offered this killer psychological help, not a name change and a gender change. Instead, for political reasons, they endorsed his delusion and children died. Glad to have your calls in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. And here's the question of the day brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Get better fast at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Should the news media hold off on the names of killers? I would answer no to that. Our illegal alien play of the day from our friend David Cross, who has tracked the activities of illegal aliens in the Northwest on this program for more than a decade. Jose de Jesus Guzman Quezada, Mexican national and registered sex offender, now arrested for immigration violations August 23rd, just 5 days ago, by Homeland Security in Seattle and in Salem. The criminal alien was previously convicted of sexual abuse, but for whatever reason, not sent out of the country. And my favorite post on X today, posted actually by our friend Ari Hoffman, breaking: Seattle PD have arrested a 49-year-old convicted rapist, Noel Stepney, after he was mistakenly released on $75,000 bail despite a jury conviction. Stepney, with a rap sheet dating back to 1991, raped a woman in her apartment after tricking her into letting him in. He now faces 13 years in jail. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
Today's Daily Grill to all the Democrats and liberals in the last 24 hours who have disparaged American Christians for saying prayers for those killed or wounded in Minneapolis and their families, and to the Minneapolis mayor for trying to shame folks who talk about the transgender motivation of the killer of children at Annunciation Catholic School. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. I've seen it with my own eyes. I had them do it for me, and it's beautiful. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or 855-CAP-THAT. Gary writes in, Lars, another school shooting by a trans person, liberal and anti-Trumper. All you need to know, they're all insane. It's a mental disorder, and the libs keep on coddling it. This is on Democrats and Minnesota Governor Tampon Tim. My friend is a counselor, and he says they still classify trans as a mental condition in the DSM manual for psychiatrists. Thanks. Signed, Gary Astorino. Let me go, first of all, to Daniel in Seattle, listening on KVI and the Radio Northwest Network. Daniel, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars, longtime listener, first-time caller.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, I just wanted to say, I think, honestly, that the media shouldn't withhold any information, but I do think that they should stop publishing the name and the photo. I believe those two examples you used were back in the day, whereas I feel like nowadays these nut jobs, they want their name in the news, they want their photo, and it sounds like this lunatic was looking up to one of the other prior killers, the one that did one of the school shootings. So I do think they should
hold
the name.
Oh, no, where did you get the impression, and which one are you referring to that he looked up to? Because I didn't see any of that. What I did see is this was a man who was very unhappy with his decision to change gender and call himself trans. And he was angry, it seems, at the whole world as a result of that, and said he was kind of trapped. He'd made the change, and then he's unhappy with the result. That seemed to be his motivation, not, gee, I want glory, or I want to be as well known as X, Y, and Z. But who did you think he was trying to emulate?
No, absolutely. I read that he looked up to the lowlife Adam, the Sandy Hook shooter.
Oh, Adam Kaczynski, the one in Newtown, Connecticut. Yeah,
I think it was Lanza.
Adam Lanza. You're right, Adam Lanza, Lanza, but Lanza wasn't trans. I mean, so what would be the comparison? Why would he have looked up?
Yeah, no, I just feel like, again, like if they didn't release any of their names, he wouldn't have them to look up to, in a sense. He wouldn't be able to, you know, like, have someone to follow in their footsteps. So even if he didn't want fame, or, you know, he was had different, you know,
would you do that by law?
That's a great question. I just think, again, the media shouldn't withhold information.
Well, let's say the media, which includes every blogger, everybody who's got a web page, so not just the, you know, the biggies, you know, not just the major networks and the major newspapers and talk shows and stuff like that. How would you keep the information from spreading on social media?
Right. No, No, it's a great question. I don't think the media should ever withhold any information. Of course, they're already corrupt and awful. But that being said, if there's a way to not say the individual's name and not release their photo, I feel like it would help. I feel like it would do more good than harm.
Okay, I'm going to throw that idea out there, Daniel, and see what people think of it. I don't think it's going to change anything, but that's just my honest reaction. I appreciate the call. Back in a moment.
The Lars Larson Show. If we keep meeting like this, people are going to talk. Here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network that at least attempts on a daily basis to serve the Pacific Northwest states with honestly provocative talk. Tomorrow, a special session of the legislature to pass the taxes that even the Democrats didn't have the guts to pass a couple of months ago when the regular session ended after six long, torturous months. And to talk about what is likely to happen tomorrow, House Minority Leader and former candidate for Governor Christine Drazen joins me now. Representative Drazen, welcome back.
Hey, Lars. So great to be with you.
Hey, can I make this very simple? Number one, is there any reason that any new taxes have to be passed for ODOT to be able to pay its bills with the money they've already got? Is there any reason to pass a new tax?
No, there's not. And is what is so crazy about this.
Go ahead. I'm sorry I interrupted.
No. This is the challenge that we've been facing. People are taking this line that the Democrats are trying to sell them as if the only way we can take care of our roads is to increase the cost burden on all of us. Just not true. This is an agency that has dedicated funding that goes to a bunch of stuff that isn't roads. So every employee across the state pays a payroll tax. They want to double it in this proposal. That wouldn't even go to roads. That would go to the empty buses that we see crossing our state and in our metro area. They are increasing title, registration, gas, you name it, in this proposal. But for them to be able to hit this issue that they're facing with just staffing, $5 million a month is what they need to find. But this proposal, as you know, $5.8 billion over the course of the 10-year projections that they're looking at this thing, they are overshooting the mark. And they're doing that on purpose. They want to raise taxes. But I believe that the money is within their existing revenues, which is well over $6 billion. Within this agency to be able to focus back on roads and stop doing all this other stuff that is climate and DEI and non-essential functions of this agency. They just don't want to let go of their political agenda. That's all this comes down to.
Okay, and I want to ask you about the tactic that ODOT has used. And, you know, ODOT is an executive branch agency. That means Kotek is responsible for it, whether she ordered it or not. She let it happen. ODOT comes out and says, you're not going to give us more money? Fine, we'll cut snow plowing, we'll cut pothole filling, we'll cut all these other things, but we're not cutting anything else, including all the things you mentioned, and I think a bunch of big projects that are dead already. That kind of tactic in a private company would be like saying, if I'm not getting my raise, boss, I'm not opening the store tomorrow morning and your customers will find a locked door. That kind of tactic would get you fired. Should that come into the equation when an agency behaves this way and say we've got $3.5 billion a year, isn't it $7 billion every 2 years or so that they've got already? And they say, if you're not going to give us more, then we're going to do the things that hurt the public the most. When an agency does that, should it get a single dime?
Well, I'm with you. I don't think that it should. And I think that she is using scare tactics with the public. And to your point, they are intentionally taking the features of their work that we actually do need. And that's been the Republican perspective all along. We have to protect boots on the ground, the people that are actually making sure that we can travel our highways regardless of season. And those are the jobs she went after because she knows that that's actually the thing that affects Oregonians directly and the most. And there were ways that she could have avoided it. She absolutely could have approached her cuts differently, but instead she chose to go after boots on the ground.
I'm talking to House Minority Leader and former gubernatorial candidate, Representative Christine Drazen. So is this thing going to be a one-day special session, or will this drag into the weekend so they can do it, you know, late on Saturday night when nobody is paying attention because it's Labor Day weekend? Is that the way it's going to go? What are you anticipating tomorrow?
You know, they would love to have this in and out on Friday for the House side. I think that they want to move this as quickly as they possibly can because they don't want Oregonians to pay attention. They don't want Oregonians to be able to come in and speak against this. And we have had to fight to even get them to do public hearings on this measure. And we had to fight to get them to do public hearings in the actual session on this measure. So, no, this is not going to be done in one day. Well, we are going to require that they're accountable to the public and that this happens over the normal course of business. And I believe that Oregonians themselves could still change the outcome on this thing. I think the extraordinary pressure that was applied at the end of the session reminded everybody that served in the legislature, Republican or Democrat, that Oregonians just cannot afford this. I really do believe strongly that Republicans were a part of pushing that fight, but we stood with the vast majority of Oregonians saying, this is a terrible proposal, and you just should not pass this. And that's where we stand today. So, no, this is not a one and done. We are going to have a methodical legislative session where we will be there on Friday. We will be there on Saturday. We will be there until this is complete. But I do not believe that it serves the public's interest for anyone to be allowed to rush this thing through. I think they have to look Oregonians in the eye. If they're going to do this, I hope as many Oregonians as possible will come to the Capitol on Friday and have their voices heard in our public hearing. I'm hoping that that public hearing will happen in the afternoon. They haven't given us a time yet, but they ignored everybody that was basically logged in to the online during our last public hearing we had. So I think it's becoming really clear that they're only wanting to handpick who they hear from. And so I think it's very important that Oregonians come into the Capitol if they can at all on Friday.
Okay. And the hearing that was held earlier this week, am I correct? Almost 3,000 people testified in one form or another, written or otherwise, and 90%+ of those said, do not raise these taxes.
Yes, sir. Yeah, it was extraordinary. Our initial count that ended at 9:30 in that same morning had that total north of 96%. And, we had about 3% of people that were neutral on the bill. And then the remaining tiny percentage there were the people that were opposed. I think that number adjusted a little bit, but it's still well north of 90% of people that have been willing to take the time and make the effort to go ahead and communicate with legislators and put their thoughts into the record. They're all opposed. None of them want this.
And by the way, some of the people got carved out time to come and testify were elected officials and agency heads. And isn't it fair to say that most of the people who testified in favor of raising the taxes are people who have a dog in the fight because either they or their agency are getting money if the taxes go up?
Yeah, that hearing was completely tilted toward the people that were going to benefit and receive direct payments from these tax increases. So, you know, I mean, I don't hold it against anybody to come and advocate for their interests. That's what our process is for. But for the chair of that committee to not balance out the voices of people that actually spoke in that hearing room was unconscionable to me. And I kept shooting him little notes saying, Rob, like, are you handpicking who you're going to here? And I could see the list. He was not going in order of the people that had signed up. He was cherry picking who he had come forward and speak. And that just means that he knew who the people were that were going to come forward and speak in support of it. Any mayor, any local elected that is going to get money through this package, of course, came forward and said our city or, you know, wants some of this money. Yeah. Of course they would do that.
You know what's sad? I would think that somebody mm-hmm. who actually represents his constituents would say, yeah, our government or our agency is going to get dough, but our people are going to get hit with the bill. Yeah. And if you're really representing the people of your city or your county or whatever, let me give you the bottom line question. I got about 40 seconds left, Representative Drazen. If they propose raising taxes and you've already said they don't need the money, they can do this without more taxes, will Republicans walk out the door and deny quorum to stop this thing?
We have every single tool has to be available to fight this, every single one, and they're all on the table. And so I want to be really clear about that. We are opposing this. We are opposing it. And right now we're in negotiating stages, but we're going to oppose this with everything we've got in us. And we're going to stand with Oregonians to fight this, but we need Oregonians to show up on Friday. If they are at all if it's at all possible, we need to see them inside the Capitol building.
Absolutely. Representative Christine Drazen, House Minority Leader, former gubernatorial candidate. Republicans are saying we're going to stop this thing. They don't need the money. And an agency like ODOT using extortionate tactics is absolutely wrong. Back in a moment. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday on the Radio Northwest Network.
Best investment in talk radio, and it's free. Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Consider this. Will high minimum wages that get pushed even higher by towns like Linwood, Washington, they are now a group called Fair Pay Play Linwood, announced plans this week to push for raising the city's minimum wage from just under $17 an hour to well over $20 an hour over the next 3 years, starting in July. They say the proposal is only going to affect businesses with 15 or more employees or those with annual gross revenues of at least $2,000, which is about $41,000 a week. That still is going to affect small businesses. And I'm going to tell you something. If Linwood, Washington is not paying attention to what has already happened in California, especially in L.A., where they jacked up minimum wages in much the same fashion and to much the same level, and they destroyed thousands and thousands of jobs, I think that is a terrible idea. To your calls on this Conspiracy Theory Thursday. And if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. This segment comes from 540training.com. Concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense. Find them online at 540training.com. Let's go to Ron. Hey, Ron, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Two things. One is the situation in Minnesota. The Democrat Party, including Tampon Timmy Chi-LaPue, the governor there, they enable the situation. The whole Democrat Party objective is using our children to divide from families, use them as a marker, then use plausible deniability to take away our independence rights, defending ourselves or anything else. By this situation here, as we that same thing's happened here in Oregon, you know, and overall, Paul, my brother, I keep thinking of you, Paul, in the Bible, but nevertheless. This is all they want to. They want to keep us divided. They plant seeds of defeatism right out of the counterculture revolution of Maoism, and they don't care. Just like on the situation Monday when they had public hearing, they loaded a deck on that, Lars. I was there, and at the same time, they don't realize. You know, I'm going to renew my license and CDL in 2 years, and it's going to cost me an extra $600 more compared to the states around us. For my CDL, gracefully never got an accident. It don't make no sense. But the main point is this, Lars, the grifters, dividers, and controllers. That's the Democrat and some rhinos. And if I had to recommend anybody, I would be there at the Capitol tomorrow. But I will say this. They better not be nobody's meeting and giving a quorum because people is tired.
I hope I pushed Drazen on that to say, can you deny them the quorum by walking out the door? And will you at the after the? And I know she wants to keep her powder dry on this, but if she says we've got every single tactic and tool available to us, we'll employ all of them. Then that's why I started with number one: can they fix ODOT's problem without more taxes? Yes. Do they need the money? No. Do they have what they need? And is this? Imagine a state agency that says we're going to get even with the citizens of Oregon. If you're not going to give us more money, we're going to take the parts of our agency that are going to hurt the public the most, and we will stop doing those things. Ron, any private employee, any private company that did that and said, we'll get even with you if you won't give us more money, you'd say that I'm never doing business with you again. The problem is they're the only game in town when it comes to government. Ron, thanks for the call. Let's go to Steve. Hey, Steve, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
I went to a meeting at Washington County this weekend, or not this weekend, Wednesday night. And you're talking about the issue down in Salem that I believe you said it'll start tomorrow.
They have a special session of the Oregon legislature. That's the group of people who write laws and pass budgets for the entire state.
Right. And on that, we were just notified out this way, Hillsboro, Oregon, about a road closure for a private entity with 3 days' notice. And we found out about it because of Willamette Week and the Hillsboro Herald.
Okay. And what does that have to do with the special session?
Well, no, it's how they're trying to cram things through.
Oh, I see. I get you. Okay. And yeah, was that the county that left you in the dark, or the city or the state? Who left you in the dark? Do you know?
Well, both the county and the city, because City of Hillsboro is, as I was led to believe through some spokesperson that I still haven't figured out who they are, they said, oh, we're not part of Washington County or City of Hillsboro. And I went, well, then why are you contacting me to settle my questions down?
Because I'll tell you what, send me more information on that issue. I'll be glad to study up on it. Thanks for the call, Steve. Let's go to Russ. Hey, Russ, we're close to the break. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, like the guy that was calling in from Seattle, the question was raised by you, I believe, that said, you know, should we really put the names out of people? And my opinion on people when they do a crime or something, and my opinion on that, Lars, is I think just like securing a crime scene, you need to secure the social media accounts of that person before and then put the name out. But I don't think the name should be put out before that. The reason being is because if you put the name out, then you're given
going out.
The people at the scene know. And before they talk to media or anything else, they need to secure all, you know, go up in the.
And you're going to go up to citizens and say you're not allowed to talk to reporters?
You know, if you can't stop that, but
you can't. And the minute they get on social media, the name is out there. So I don't think there's a way to lock it down. But thanks for the call.
The Lars Larson.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com, and you can find our X poll. That's the daily poll question we put up out of the news of the day. You'll find that at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. I want to talk about vote by mail and election systems that depend on mail-in ballots and ultimately chain of custody that does not exist. Dr. Douglas Frank joins me now, who's a world-renowned physicist, inventor, and elections expert. Dr. Frank, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
You've been taking a look at elections all over the United States, but I'd like you to take a look or tell us in particular about the election systems in Oregon and Washington, which have been dependent on vote by mail for the last couple of decades. I've never liked the system, and having watched it in operation, I like it even less now. Is there any reason to believe that it's a solid, secure system of voting?
No reason at all. In fact, President Trump, about a week and a half ago, even made a tweet and said that he's going to start a national movement to get rid of mail-in voting. So you're clearly in the crosshairs out there in the Northwest.
No doubt. Now let's talk about the particulars. You looked at some of the elections results, and you determined that the turnout rates for registered voters, and you looked at the numbers, and you said the numbers don't really add up.
Yeah, I've done extensive analysis. I'm about to be in Oregon. I'm going to be in Oregon for about 10 days starting next week.
Gathering of Eagles is the event you're going to be speaking at, correct?
Yes, that's one of them. Yes.
Yes.
And I'm doing prospecting as well. I'm going county to county. I've got several teams, about a dozen or so teams already functioning in Oregon for about a year now. And what we've been doing is we've been taking multiple copies of the voter rolls for, and this applies to mail-in voting, which is why I'm bringing it up a little bit. I've got 5 years worth of your voter rolls. It's 4 years span, but five copies, you know, five copies of the rolls, 1 year in between each of them. And I've analyzed every voter in the voter rolls in every county in the state of Oregon. So I can track them through. In other words, you know, John Smith was in the rolls in 2021. He's still in the rolls in 2025. He voted a couple of times in between. Fine. But I've tracked every voter like that. And the reason I'm doing that is because I'm helping the counties to find fraudulent voting. And how